Audi.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Big Travel Podcast, exploring life stories through travel. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Our guest today for this extra special additional episode is someone very special to me. After being born in the Commonwealth country of Fiji, he travelled the world, arriving in the UK in the 1960s to live in the city of Liverpool just when the Beatles and other famous bands were getting into full swing. He went on to live in Spain, run a magazine, bars, restaurants, and now almost 80 is not resting yet, writing children's books when he's not looking after his grandchildren. He gives a fascinating insight into the South Pacific and what it was like to grow up under British colonial rule. Despite growing up in a house made of bamboo in what some people would call poverty, it was a happy childhood for the kids whose playground was the lush fields of the sugarcane plantation, the mango trees, the winding river where they swam as their mums washed their clothes, and of course the beautiful Fijian beaches. There were sad times too, and it's quite an emotional interview, I have to say, although there's lots of laughter as well amongst a few tears. It's a fascinating story, so let's give it a proper introduction. Christopher Tepeshwe Nand grew up in Fiji as an Indian Fijian, the grandchild of the indentured labour system which saw 3 million Indians displaced around the world under colonial British rule. He grew up in a house made of bamboo, was taken away from home aged just 6 to be educated by Catholic missionaries, and grew up to be champion boxer of Fiji. His move to Liverpool in the early 60s was timely for a 21-year-old music fan, just as the Beatles were taking over. He's very special to me. A big welcome to my dad, Chris Nand. Should we start with introducing who you are? You're my dad, and your name is Chris Nand, but that's not your actual real name, was it? Your first name was Tepeshwe?
Well, when I was born, I had a Hindu name. My mum gave me this name called Tepeshwe. Tepeshwe means a saint, you know. At the age of 6, the missionaries came, and they took the children in to a boarding school. At 6, I was baptized and given this name, Christopher.
But you still have Tepeshwe as a middle name?
It's my middle name, yeah, so. Yeah.
Do you feel like Christopher now? Or if someone called Tepeshwe, would you turn around?
As a matter of fact, yes, because it's a unique name. I've never in my life heard anybody called Tepeshwe.
So where did she get it from?
I don't know. It's one of these religious people who go into the Himalayas to pray. They give their life to God. Yeah, that sort of thing.
That's a nice name, actually, a nice meaning. She obviously knew, everyone who meets you says you're a nice, calming person. I mean, I know different, that you've been a boxer and everything, but people say that you've got this calming aura. Maybe it's...
Well, as you grow older, I wasn't always like that. As you grow older, you mellow, you know. So now, I think there's no point being aggressive or... In my younger days, you know, I used to... like a scrap, and I go in the street in Fiji, we had nothing else to do. We had no TV. So at night you went out and you had a bit of a scrap with, you know, a fight or whatever.
But you got involved in boxing professionally, but we'll get onto that in a minute. I think what might be interesting to some people is that you were born in Fiji, but you're of 100% Indian blood. And this is because of something called the indentured labour system.
Right, yeah, right.
Which was essentially... something akin to slave labour, that the British took about 3 million Indians, it turns out, in the end, from India and distributed them in various colonies around the world and used them for whatever labour they needed. In Fiji, it was the sugar plantation. So these were your, it was your grandparents, was it, that came
over? My grandparents came from India. My maternal and paternal grandparents came from India. My maternal grandfather, he was 14, and my grandmother was 12. They went to the office in Calcutta where they were recruiting people, and my grandfather did. He was telling me a story when he did ask the officer where Fiji was. And he said, oh, it's only a day's travel from here, we'll be in Fiji. But 90 days later, they arrived in Fiji. Several people had died on the way, and eventually they had to build their houses, clear the forest, grow sugarcane. And this is how the Indians came to live in Fiji.
And it's been well documented now that was a lot of great hardship for them. There were a lot of people died, there were rapes, murders, mm-hmm. and the landowner, who was in charge? Was it the British and the Australians?
It was a sugar refining company called Colonial Sugar Refining Company. They were exporting sugar from Fiji.
What else did your grandparents tell you about that time? Do you know where they came from in India?
Again, going back to my maternal grandfather, they came from Faizabad, Ayodhya, and that's all I knew. But the DNA that we had, that proved different. That said that 74% of, what was it, 80, sorry.
It was the DNA test that you recently had done indicated, I think that was 6% Melanesian, yeah. which is from the South Pacific, which yeah. is really interesting because you are born in the South Pacific with no South Pacific blood.
No.
But I think what it indicates, and my very basic research on Google, and I would love to know more about this if anyone knows, is that a bit like the British have about 6% Scandinavian DNA right, because right. of the Vikings and people coming over from yeah. Northern Europe, people in Southern India especially have Melanesian DNA from people coming up from the South Pacific Islands. Right.
Well, that was puzzling because 80%, I think, of my DNA was in South India, which I never knew that at all, and about 10% from East India. I had no idea. I always thought I came, you know, we originated from north.
People came from all over India and ended up in Fiji.
Yes.
So they were mixing all their castes. They were
yeah,
mixing.
the caste system was abandoned then, because the caste system in India, which still exists today, that was all thrown out of the window. Because people mix their intermarriages and all that, and this is the way, you know, it all happened.
So they had this incredible hardship. Do you know from your paternal grandparents what their story was?
I was very little. I was only about maybe 4 years old when my father told me. I saw this old man. He was dressed in his Indian outfit. And my father said, this is your grandfather. That's all I know.
So your grandparents have settled in Fiji. They had a really hard time. But after, like everyone, going through the indentured labour system, working in the sugar cane plantations, and then after that everyone was given a lease of land.
Yes, they had to lease the land and grow sugar cane. So my grandparents, they leased land, and we were brought up on a sugar cane plantation.
What, describe to me what that was like.
Well, childhood days, it was amazing. We had lots of cousins, and it was really good. I enjoyed my life on the farm. We had animals, we had cows, horses. My grandchildren ask me now about it, so I talk about it. We had the river to swim in. Food was plentiful, you know. It was a good life, really enjoyed it. There was no poverty, even though we ate the same sort of food every day that we grew in the farm, rice, corn. But we were happy, you know. We had our own water supply from the river. So life was really good. The houses were made from bamboo, and we didn't know any different. So we lived in this village. All the houses were made of thatch roof and bamboo floor. Everybody, you know, all my family lived like that, all my uncles and aunties, so we didn't know any difference. This is the way life was.
And I remember saying to me, you didn't have shoes until you were 7 years old.
Yeah, that's a good question, yeah. No one had shoes. We used to go on the bus with no shoes. I had shoes, sandals, when I was about 14. They were my first shoes, yeah.
Your first shoes were when you were 14?
Yeah.
And is this because of lack of money, or this is just what everyone looked like?
Well, it was lack of money, I suppose. We just had enough money to get by. Like I said, when I went to school, you know, nobody in the school had shoes. That's the way it was. We accepted all that.
But you used to walk for miles a day. When you first started going to school with your big brothers, you used to walk yeah. for miles, didn't you?
I think we walked about 4 miles there and back.
How many siblings did you have at this point?
Altogether, my mum had 11 children. Some died at birth. But some of my brothers and sisters were my half-brothers and sisters because my mum was married before. And her husband died when she had 3 children. So she remarried. Well, in those days, it wasn't my mom was only very young when she had 3 children. And the village elders, it is an Indian culture. A widow is classed as untouchable in those days. Nobody will want to remarry or marry a widow. So the village elders got together and got my dad, who was the younger brother of her first husband, and they got them together. And that's when my elder brother was born, Thomas. Well, his name was Ambikanand. When we went to boarding school, we were all baptized and our names were, we had Christian names then.
I want to get onto that in a minute because that's quite a heartfelt moment, I think, when you were taken away to Catholic boarding school for the first time. But tell me about your pet bull, because there's a lovely story about your pet bull on the farm that when I was a child, I always used to love to hear.
Well, we had lots of animals, like I said before. And I remember this bull being born. We all watched it being born. And in the morning, I went to the little baby calf and we touched it, my mom and dad, everybody. We got used to playing with this bull all the time. As it grew, it began to follow us. I was only maybe about 12, and the bull used to follow me. So everywhere I went, the bull, in the farm, the bull came. Even when I went on a horse, the bull used to follow me.
You were riding bareback on horses?
Yeah, bareback on horses. Yeah, we had no saddle or anything. When I left for boarding school, then the bull, my mom used to say, tell me the story, the bull used to still put his head down in the house.
Oh.
Yeah, and look.
Looking for you.
Yeah.
Oh, because he used to try and follow you in the house.
Well, it came up to the door, yeah. A lovely black, a shiny black coat in that really lovely bull, yeah. Anyway, it's a long story.
It's a nice story, though. So your mother lost some children, I remember.
Yeah, she lost a brother and sister before me. They were twins. They died after 6 days. It makes me wonder how I survived, because it was in primitive conditions. We had no running water, sanitary, everything was really very primitive. So when the children were born, there were no proper midwives, aunties, whoever, they helped out. Umbilical cords were cut by a pair of scissors or razor blade or whatever. And when I look back to see where I was born, it makes me wonder how I survived. Yeah? So I was really lucky to survive.
I've been into that field where you were born, next to the mango tree. Is that the one we went to? Is that the one you grew up?
That's the place I was born, yeah.
Yes, and the same mango tree that your house was next to was still there.
Yeah,
the mango
still
tree
there,
you played
yeah.
with,
yeah,
the river that you used to jump in.
Yeah, you went to see it, yeah, you and Marcus.
Fiji, I mean, there's quite a lot of poverty in Fiji still, and I think people don't realise that. It's a place of contrasts, you know. There's the £10,000 a night resorts and beautiful resorts, but there's also quite a lot of poverty, and there has been quite a lot of political unrest, although luckily that seems to have been in a period of stability for a while.
Yeah.
So what was it like as a child there? Because you're living in a tropical climate.
Yes.
So it's beautiful and beautiful and green, but it's beautiful and green for a reason. There's a lot of rain.
Right.
And the weather can be very unstable. You told me a lovely story about going to the shops for your mum in a hurricane?
Well, it was starting of a hurricane in the morning. Hurricane warnings were on the radio and we were told to stay in, don't go out. But my mom needed something from the shop, so I went. But coming back, well, I was walking against the wind going, but coming back, I almost flew back. The wind was behind me. So one of those daredevil things that I wouldn't do now, but it was one of those things I had to do. I don't know why, what made me do it.
What about the tidal wave? Wasn't there a tidal wave once as well?
There was a tidal wave when I worked in the city, yes. Fortunately, only one or two people had died. Where I was working at that time, there was a river next to it, and the brunt of the tidal wave went through the river, and I where I worked, it was safe. So next day when we went back to work, everything was all right.
So what was the time when you were sheltering in the only brick building in the village? Was that the hurricane?
That was a hurricane in 1953, I think. All the hurricane was quite strong. All the houses in the village, all the corrugated roof, metal roof, blew away our house as well. And we are sheltering in one brick house in the village. But I think we were there about 10 minutes when the strong winds came and blew the roof away. And
so you're sheltering in the building and the roof blew away?
Yeah.
That must have been terrifying.
We saw the roof lifted, as a matter of fact, yeah.
That must have been terrifying.
Yeah, it was terrifying, but fortunately it didn't last long. So after a while we were all right.
So you're born in 1939. Were there any signs of the war that was still going on, well, just starting, actually, in Europe?
I remember when I was about 4, the Fijian village that was close to us, about the indigenous people, I used to hear them crying. And later I was told that there were some bodies coming back to the village from Singapore, where the Fijian military was. Actually know what happened in Europe. I had no idea till I went to school and started to read.
So the indigenous Fijians were in the British Army, I'm guessing?
Yes, indigenous people. Even now, today, I think Fiji is the only country where they have Fijians in the SAS. There are quite a few there, yeah.
So what age were you when you were taken to boarding school?
It was just after my 5th birthday when the missionaries came. They came to the village. I remember my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, getting them to sit behind some trees or something. We had lots of palm trees around the house and mango trees. And next minute I remember my grandfather, the missionaries were welcomed in the village. A prize goat was slaughtered. They had goat curry and rice, and before I realized I was...
I know, it's upsetting. It's upsetting for me too. I've got a 5-year-old, so to think of them being taken away. It's a nice record to have for the boys.
Yeah, before I realized I was in the jeep leaving for...
We haven't got on to the really sad bits yet.
Leaving for boarding school, which was about 150 miles from home. So that's where I spent 10 years of my life.
That must have been devastating, leaving. I mean, I know you're upset about it now. Sorry, Dad. Leaving your village and everything. It was the best thing for you, though.
Yes. Leaving your mum and dad is hard at that age. My brother was there before me at the boarding school, so it was comforting, you know.
In a way. I say that because I know that, you know, there was maybe, you've defended this in a way that you've said that was the culture, but he wasn't always very nice to you, was he?
I think the elder brothers tend to bully, you know. Not nowadays, but I'm talking about the olden days. I was bullied, yeah, I was bullied in school. And being a Hindu culture, we're not supposed to argue with our elders. We're not supposed to fight back or whatever. So I just had to take it and persevere with it. That's the way it was.
You're being educated at the school, which is in a little village called Bar, which the very...
You've been to my school.
Yeah, we went there together and it was incredible. And they still had a record in the office of... Yeah. We couldn't see your name, could we? But we could see the name of your brother and your classmates.
I wonder why, because I was there for 10 years.
Well, I imagine that keeping records wasn't their strong point back in, what are we talking, it's the 1940s?
Yeah, 1946
in Fiji. But we did, the school is still there, looks more or less exactly the same. You took me down the back, told me, oh, this is where we live, these are the shower cubicles. So you're being educated and living with Irish Catholic nuns and priests.
Right.
What were the nuns like?
Well, some of the nuns were really very, very friendly. They really looked after us well. Well, one... two nuns that were quite... the head nun, she ran the place with an iron fist. We were beaten up quite a lot. So that's the part of growing up, I suppose.
And not really, not everyone gets beaten up by nuns.
You call it character building now. In the olden days, everybody got hit, you know what I mean? You can't smack children now, but in those days we did.
Yeah, but by nuns.
Well, you read about nuns in Ireland. Worse things happen in Ireland. People were, you know, see the films now. It was tough, but it gave me education, which I'm grateful for.
And they taught you how to box? The priests taught you how to box?
Well, only because I was bullied in school. The priest, Irish missionaries they were, he taught me how, one of the priests, he taught me how to box. So
when it came to leaving school, you were what, 14 years old?
I was 14. I had a chance to go to, pass my exams to go to a college, St. Xavier's College, which is quite famous in Fiji. And my parents couldn't afford the fees, so I had to drop out and start work.
But you, at one point, were you thinking about, or somebody suggested you were going to become a priest?
Yes, I forgot that part of the story. But all the children in our boarding school, we were more or less brainwashed to be, the only way when redemption was to become a priest or nun. The nuns had planned to send me to Ireland to study and become a priest and then return back to Fiji, which didn't happen, obviously.
Why didn't you want to become a priest?
Well, at first the idea was good. I thought I'll travel, but by the time I was 14, I started to box, and I had no inclination to go to Ireland and become a priest.
Oh, just before we get onto your boxing career, I'm going to make you cry again now. Sorry about that, Dad. But it's a lovely record to have for our family, but also I think this is a fascinating part of history that people don't know about, and it's British history. You know, we are responsible for taking one half of me is responsible for taking, you know, and disrupting the lifestyle and creating Indian Fijians, as they are now known. Once you'd finished school, you went back to the village for a while,
right,
before you went to live in the city. And just to explain that the culture was still very, very Indian. The women were the homemakers and the cooks and the cleaners, and the men are going off and earning their living. And there's still a very strong culture. There was still a very strong culture. There probably is a little bit of arranged marriage.
Yes.
And sometimes that works for people and sometimes it doesn't. Yeah. You know, it's a controversial point for people over here in the UK, but I know there are many successful incidences of it. Now, so I am going to upset you because I know this story, so I'm going to ask you about your sister. Sorry. It's a shame because we had this all on camera when we went to Fiji together, I think twice. And all those tapes were stolen once on a train from Liverpool to London.
Yeah. Well, my sisters, my three sisters' marriage were arranged. They're very happily married. They had children. But my sister, younger sister, I think she was only 15, when my father had arranged her wedding marriage with an older man, which at that time, I was 17. I didn't realize what was happening. I was too involved in my own life. I was boxing and training and planning to leave Fiji. I had no idea what was going on behind the scene. So one morning I left home to go to work, and midday someone came on the bike running over to me and told me that my sister had committed suicide. So I rushed home, and there she was. I just saw her.
And she'd hung herself in the well.
Yes.
So you then had this horrible, unimaginably horrible trip to hospital with your sister that you told me about.
Well, what happened, my father was digging a well because the river that was next to the home was polluted. So my father was digging a well for fresh water. And that's where there was a piece of wood over the well where she hung herself. So next minute, when I arrived home, I saw her lying on the...
Sorry. Are you okay telling it?
Yes.
It's a good record to have, yeah? We'll get on to the happiest stuff in a
Yeah, I saw her lying under a blanket. My mum very upset, and we were all crying. And next minute we heard the police siren. The police jeeps stopped and came along. And they had to take her body to the general hospital for post-mortem. And they wanted somebody to come, but my father couldn't leave my... body there with me.
Sorry.
And we went to the hospital and where they did postmortem. And then I had to find a vehicle to take us back. So at that age, it's very hard to. So I found somebody who took us back to the village. And then she was buried, all the family members came, and that was the, you know.
But you had to carry her, didn't you?
Only to the burial ground, yeah, we all had to carry her. Yeah.
And did anything change in your family after that?
No, unfortunately, a lot of Indian girls in Fiji at that time were committing suicide. Because of the culture, they were getting forced into, bamboozled into getting married to older men. It happened a lot in England today. There's a lot of arranged marriages. You always read about daughters being murdered, and people still do it. So in Fiji, people have gone, in the city, people have gone quite modern now. They meet the girls, and later on, they're married. They call it a love marriage or arranged marriage, you know, so the culture has changed quite a lot now.
And I have to say that although we're talking about lots of sad things, that's it, the sad things are over, is that you came from a very loving, wonderful, happy family.
Oh, lovely, lovely family. My mum was a saint, really. She loved her. You know, she's so good to us. I miss her now.
So you go off to Suva, which is the capital of Fiji. Now, I've been to Fiji a couple of times, and Suva is still this very colonial looking capital with these beautiful old buildings, and it's very hot and oppressive and scented, and there's a market. It's a very small capital, but it's beautiful and tropical and exotic, and I can't imagine what it'd be like in the 50s when you went to live there.
Well, when I go back to Fiji now, it's just like going back into time about 50 years. Things hasn't changed. The roads are the same, traffic lights. There were no traffic lights when I lived there, yeah. What do you call it? Lampposts along the roadside. They're all the same. So it seems like that I've gone back into time. And it's different, it's calm. The indigenous people and the Indians, they get on very well at the moment. They do have a military coup now and again, but eventually they make up.
Yeah, there hasn't been one for quite a while. And hopefully, I know there used to be quite a lot of inequality for Indian people, as they weren't necessarily seen as equal. But I think, speaking to certainly some members of our family over there now, is things are good now, which is good.
Things are good at the moment. But a lot of my family, my nephews and nieces, they left Fiji now. They live in Australia or New Zealand.
Yeah, there's been a huge brain drain because there wasn't the jobs for the young people, and people have unfortunately...
Yeah. Well, you met them in Australia and New Zealand. They're all, fortunately, quite affluent now.
Everyone's done really well. I mean, I think there's, like in any family, there's people from all scales of background. But I do remember the very first time I went to Fiji, and we couldn't afford to go when we were younger, because it's four flights to literally the other side of the world. You can't go any further than Fiji without coming back. And so I didn't go until I was an adult, and I went on my own with my then boyfriend, David, now my husband. And the very first time, because I grew up in England and Spain, and I never met anyone brown skin that I was related to, it was only you. So the very first time I met a relative of yours in Fiji was incredible. And I remember sitting in this lovely hotel in Suva waiting to meet Ben, my cousin, your brother's son. And I was smiling at everyone who came through the door because I had no idea what he really looked like. But then to meet Ben and to see him looking like you, and, you know, and he does look a lot like you and a lot like his dad, your brother who died in the 1980s. And to see him was incredible. And I've grown up on these stories that you've told us about poverty and no shoes and everything. Ben picked us up in his brand new Range Rover, took us to his factory on the way and said, "This is my factory." I was like, "Oh, this is what I was expecting." That night, we were having dinner in this most beautiful floating restaurant in Suva Harbour, sitting next to the Prime Minister of Fiji.
Amazing, yeah.
And a very, very well-known television journalist next door. And then Ben insisted on paying, you know, he got his gold card out, and I thought, oh, this is not what I was expecting at all.
Yeah.
It's nice to see that they've done well.
Yeah.
And they're happy. So you became a boxer. Instead of becoming a priest, you became a boxer, and you became champion boxer of Fiji.
In boarding school, we were always boxing each other, so the sorted the bullies out in the end. So this is why I was boxing. Fortunately, the priest taught me how to box, and eventually I had to box one of the bullies, and I beat him up quite badly, really. And then when I went to live in Suva, I went to a boxing club that was run by the lightweight champion of Fiji, a guy called Daniel Nathan. He had just lost the lightweight championship of the South Seas to a Tongan guy. So rematch was arranged not in Suva, but in Tonga, in the town of Nuku'alofa. It's not a city, it's just a small place. And I was to accompany him because I was one of the lightweight contenders for his title. We couldn't fight because he was my best friend. So off we go to Tonga in the hurricane conditions. The boat normally takes about 2 days to get there, but it took us 3.5 days. And we couldn't walk on the ship. The hurricane was that bad. We were throwing up and everything. And when we arrived in Tonga, we were both very, very weak and whatever. But after a while, Tongan manager met us. He had a restaurant, so we lived there in his house. We ate at the restaurant, we trained, and after a while we were fit. And we won our both fights, first fights. And the second fight we won as well. And by this time, one day, we were training boxing in our club. Not a club like boxing club in London, but old weights and primitive conditions. We were training and suddenly some people came in the gym. And the Tongans all fell on their knees. I thought, who is this guy? And I was told he was the crown prince of Tonga. George Topo, somebody, I can't remember his name. I have to Google it. One of the guys said, carry on sparring. So I was sparring with my lightweight champion friend, Daniel Nathan. We were sparring. So I really went, because the prince was watching, I really went toe-to-toe with him. And he was all bleeding and everything. When the prince went away, he was very angry with me. He said, let's sort this out in the ring. You know, I'm going to kill you in the ring and all that. So he was my best friend. So we fell out. The next minute, my manager arranged a fight with me, and a 15-round fight at the local rugby ground, built for the lightweight championship of Fiji. So I went in. I had a very good manager. He told me to box him, not to fight him, because this guy was a fighter. He was like a bull in a china shop. He came after you. So the fight time day, he... The bell went and he came after me, guns blazing. And my manager said to me to just box him. So I boxed him and I won the fight on points. So my hand was lifted as a lightweight champion of Fiji. He stormed after the ring, he took the belt, everything, and he went, swearing and whatever. And next day he took the boat and came to Fiji. And I was left there on my own. I had another fight with the lightweight champion of Tonga. I won that on points. And then when I came to Fiji, I challenged this guy for the title in Fiji, but it didn't happen. I beat him in Tonga. It wasn't recognized by the Boxing Board of Control because the fight was held in Tonga and it should have been held in Fiji in front of the Boxing Board of Control. So I tried to fight this guy again, but it was too late. I was getting ready to come to go to New Zealand. And later, months later, my cousin wrote to me and said the title was vacant for about 18 months or so before somebody else fought for the title.
Two stories I want to ask you about before we leave Fiji. Mm. Well, first of all, is in Tonga. Now, you were taken to the palace to meet...
Right,
the...
right.
So yes. Tell me about going to the palace in Tonga.
We were invited to meet the prince. The morning of the invitation to the palace, our manager said to us that when you enter the palace, you have to wear a piece of mat around your waist. I had a suit on, but on top of my suit, I had to wear a piece of mat. That was the Tongan culture.
Like almost like a skirt.
Skirt, yeah. So as we arrived at the gates of the palace, we were given this piece of mat to wear. A little boy met us. We followed him to the palace. Outside the palace, they had a veranda. He knocked on the veranda like waking a baby, you know. And next minute, a giant-looking guy came. He asked us to follow him. So we went inside the palace in the study, and we waited there for a while until the prince came. And we shook his hands. Drinks arrived. We, not beer. The Methodists, they don't drink at all. So we had fruit juice, pineapple juice or something. But fortunately, while we were there, we met an Indian guy who he was the queen's cook. His name was Billy. They called him Billy India because he was Billy. He's an Indian guy. So he invited us to his house where he laid on a full banquet, Indian food and rice and goat curry. As we were leaving the palace, we saw a pool. And I asked the guide, is this a royal pool? He said, no, this pool belongs to the tortoise. Tortoise? As we were walking past, we saw this tortoise, huge tortoise. He took us to the tortoise and he started telling the story that this tortoise was given to the kingdom of Tonga by Captain Cook 200 years ago. And I thought, wow, because they do live for a long time, yeah. So I think his name is Tui Malaya or something like that. I have to Google. I should have been ready for that.
I'll do it now. Let's have a look. Yeah, Tui Malila.
Yeah.
Malila? Yeah.
Right. So this tortoise was called Tui Malila. And he has survived about 200 years. Years later, when I was living in England, I saw a newspaper cutting somewhere that the turtle has died. Not natural death. It was kicked by a horse somewhere.
Right, I just looked it up and it's actually Tui Malila, 1777
yeah.
to 19th of May, 1965.
Right.
It was a tortoise that Captain James Cook was traditionally said to have given to the royal family of Tonga. Mm-hmm. It's the longest living tortoise whose age has been verified. That's incredible that you met a tortoise that was hatched in 1777.
I was fortunate enough to see this tortoise.
That's incredible. Yeah. Yes, upon his Captain Cook's royal visit to Tonga in July 1777. That's incredible. So just before we leave Fiji, I want to talk about your dad, because this is before you were hatching plans. Sorry about the hatching tortoise pun. You were hatching plans to leave Fiji and travel the world and go to India go to England. One main reason, obviously you feel you're British, you live in the Commonwealth, and I'm guessing, why did you want to go to England?
That was the only place we could. We were Fiji, part of the Commonwealth. So some of my friends have gone to America because they have relatives there and they sponsored them. And so the only place I could go was England. I thought I'll go to England, and that's why I came to England.
And you met a man who told you that you could go and stay with his family. You met a Scouser, did you, in Fiji?
Well, I met this guy in Fiji when I used to work for an engineering company called Bish Limited. I worked there, and the foreman there was from Birkenhead. So we became friends, and he used to come and watch me box and all that. And I used to get invited to his house in Suva. We were really good friends. So when I came to live in New Zealand, he had already moved to New Zealand. So I met him again in New Zealand. I looked for him, and we met him again. And when I was coming to England, he gave me stuff to bring for his mum and dad, who lived in just outside Liverpool. So this is how I took the train from London to Liverpool, and I lived there for 20 years.
But didn't he give you something ridiculous, like exact directions to get to their house?
Right, directions, yeah. That was amazing. He told me to get off the train at Lime Street. He said, walk over. I've got my plans. I got off at Lime Street. I looked at my plan. He said, walk over, look for Central Station. So I went to Central Station, right down the steps, took the train there. And he said, when you come out on the other side, he said, come out at Rock Ferry Station and go up the steps. So I'm still looking at my plan. I went up the steps. He said, get the number 10 bus from there. So I saw the number 10, got on the bus, and he told me to get off at a place called New Ferry. And just across the road is this road where his mom and dad lived, at number 4 Woodward Road. So it worked out exactly the same. I got the bus, I went there, I went to the house, knocked on the door, his mom and dad came to greet me, and I stayed there for a while.
They took you in and said, come and stay.
Yeah, yes.
That's incredible. I love that story.
Yeah.
Slightly before, backtracking a little bit, so you arrived, you decide to travel the world and eventually end up in England. That's your plan.
Right,
now. But your first stop was New Zealand. Now, as far as I recall, you arrived there with no money and nowhere to stay. Tell me the story about the Catholic lady.
I was planning to leave Fiji. We had no money. I was getting very little money. It was not enough to travel. So my mum, she pawned her jewelry. She had some jewelry, some bangles or whatever. And my elder brother, he pawned some musical instruments to make up my fare from Fiji to New Zealand. But I still needed another £30, which I didn't have. But fortunately, I had met a man before my travels. He said he will be help me out with my bond. So we got on our flight at Dundee Airport.
Is this the first time you've been on a plane?
Yes. By the time we arrived in Auckland, he had a lot to drink already. He was inebriated. So by the time we arrived at immigration, he was too drunk to sponsor me. The immigration officers, I heard them talking. They looked at my passport, and I heard the immigration officer say to his junior partner that we might have to send him back to Fiji. So I was really scared. But eventually they came up to me and they saw this drunk guy with me. And I said, he's my sponsor, but I'm afraid he's drunk. So fortunately, the immigration officer, he said, okay, come back with him Monday morning.
When he's sobered up.
But we'll keep your passport here because, you know, you might do a runner. So I went to Auckland. Fortunately, the bus from the airport to Auckland was a free ride airport bus. So we arrived in Auckland and we went to a cafe. By the time we arrived there, he had disappeared. So I had nowhere to go. I had my suitcase, I had nowhere to go. I'm standing in the middle of Auckland Main Street.
The biggest city I've ever seen.
So I began to ask people anywhere I could find a bed and breakfast or whatever. I had no money anyway.
How old were you?
I was 21, just 21. So I kept on walking and walking. I came to a street called Ponsonby Road. There were bed and breakfast places, but nobody I had no money. So I said, I'll pay you as soon as I find a job. But nobody was interested. Eventually, I saw a place that had lots of statues outside, Virgin Mary, crucifix and all that. So I went up the steps and I knocked on the door and a lady came. I think she was Irish. I told her my story. I said, I don't have any money, but as soon as I find a job, I'll pay you. And she looked at me and she said, what religion are you, son? I said, I'm Catholic. She said, okay. She said, come in. So I went in. She showed me a room. She gave me a nice bowl of stew. And Monday morning, she took me back to immigration and she signed my guarantor and I was fine. And she also found me a job. I was working, earning a lot of money. I was earning £45 a week, which was a lot of money because in Fiji, I was only getting £2 a week. So I managed to save my fare from there to England.
Was it something awful like packing meat and you're not the biggest meat eater in the
world? No. She told me where to go for a job. So I went to this abattoir. I didn't even know what an abattoir was. And the personnel officer interviewed me. I said, can you shoot animals? I said, no. So eventually gave me a job in a freezer packing meat, lifting boxes of meat.
And the one thing you were was strong.
So I was working with a lot of Maoris there, made some friends, and I stayed there for 4 months. Fortunately, I paid my fare to England. After 4 months, I was on my way to England.
Did you go to England with some friends? There was a group of you?
Yeah, there were Fijians, Fiji Indians, yeah.
So what year are we talking?
1961.
So you're getting the boat from New Zealand to England in 1961. What was that like?
That was an amazing trip, really. It took us to Tahiti. From Tahiti, we came through the Panama Canal. We stayed there a day in the canal. It was one of these cargo ship passengers that carried passengers, so fortunately stayed a day here and a day there. So when we left Panama, we sailed very near Cuba, and people pointed out the islands of Cuba, and then we went to New York and London. But we didn't realize at that time when we were sailing next to Cuba what was actually happening in Cuba. It was the Bay of Pigs, you know, that time. There was Che Guevara and all those people. Everything was happening, but I didn't realize what was happening there until I arrived in England.
Oh, no, but you stopped in New York on the way. What was that?
Yeah,
like
New York. We stayed in New York for a day in New York. Yeah, it was lovely, amazing. Going up the Empire State Building, going up the Liberty Statue, all that is very, very exciting.
So you arrived in England, the promised land where the streets are paved with gold, but of course it isn't. What was it like when you arrived? What time of year was it?
Fortunately, it was April.
It
wasn't too cold. Still, it was very cold, yeah.
Now, you still have the suitcase, the very suitcase that your mum pawned her jewellery to buy you in Fiji. And you still have that in our house, in your home in Spain.
That's for sentimental reasons. I have to keep that. Yeah.
I'm so pleased you kept it. But the suitcase itself has a brilliant story. You arrived after your 6-week boat journey in Southampton. Where was your suitcase?
When I went to collect my suitcase, I was told they couldn't find it. So I left Southampton to London to Liverpool without a case and no change of clothing. And 3 months later, the boat had go around the world a couple of times before it came back to Liverpool.
So you got no money, you're living in England. What did you do for clothes?
Wash, you know, every day, wash, shower.
You're about to hit the swinging 60s in Liverpool. This must have been an incredible time to arrive there.
It was, yeah, because people were very friendly. People of Liverpool were very, very friendly. We went to all the clubs. It was the time with the Beatles.
I remember asking you how you were treated, and I know there was racism, particularly when you started to have a relationship with my mum, a local girl, and also when you got married, there was racism and prejudice. But at one point you said that you also felt like rock stars.
The people in Liverpool and Birkenhead, where we were, the people gave us, my friend and I had a friend with me, like a rock star treatment. There are lots of places there people, children, haven't seen black people or coloured people, whatever. So sometimes walking down the little towns in the country, we used to get surrounded. People looking at us, you know. So it was really, I'm talking about 56 years ago, not like today.
I think there's probably still villages in England now that would still happen.
Yeah, it was a remote village in Cheshire.
And you got a job on the buses?
Well, we tried to find jobs. We went to factories.
This is you and your friend David?
Yeah, David. I had met him in New Zealand, so we travelled together. And we tried to find jobs. There was no jobs at all. The only jobs was on the buses. So I was driving a bus for 5 years. So I remember when I first went in for an interview for the job on the buses, the personnel officer, he said, "Where do you know in Liverpool? Do you know Central Stations?" And no. "Do you know the market?" "No, sir." So he said, "I'm afraid I can't give you a job because you don't know the area." So we were just moving out of the office when he said to hold back. And he gave us a map. He said, "Come back within 2 weeks. If you have learned the whole area, I'll give you a job." So we went on different buses. We walked certain places. We learned everything. We went back after 2 weeks and we were employed.
You're in Liverpool. It's the 60s. The Beatles are just about to kick off in a big way in Liverpool first before they go to London with an interlude in Hamburg. And so what was your first involvement with the music scene? I know when Mum used to go to the Cavern at lunchtime when she was working near the Docklands area.
Yeah.
So what was your first introduction to the Liverpool music scene?
I met your mum at a gymnasium in Wallasey. I was working out and your mum came in. She was about 17, I think. And she came in with her friends to work out. She was the captain of a Cheshire netball, junior netball team. So we met at this gym and then we started dating. And from there, she took me to Liverpool. She introduced me to the music scene in Liverpool because she used to work in an office not far from the Cavern. So they used to go there lunchtime to listen to the Beatles play. So I was introduced to the Beatles. I remember going down the Cavern, having a drink, and your mum pointed out John, Paul, Ringo. No, it wasn't Ringo. It was Pete Best that time, yeah. We didn't become friends or anything when we saw them. And the next time we saw them was in a club in Birkenhead called the Majestic. I remember going in, the Beatles coming in, They weren't even headlining. The Beatles were by third on, and then Cilla Black came on, and she was called Priscilla White. I think she sang a song, Summertime or something, yeah.
It must have been a brilliant time to be in Liverpool.
Yes, it was really nice. And eventually, little by little, I got into the music scene, yeah.
Well, I know that you and Mum made a... We've got photos, and I will share them, but you and Mum made a fantastic-looking couple. You very dark, obviously, and standing out. And Mum, incredibly beautiful and wearing all these fabulous 60s miniskirts.
Yes, she was beautiful, yeah. Lovely hair.
When you eventually got married, she got married in a white leather mini dress and jacket that she'd made herself.
Yes.
Well, it wasn't without difficulties because, you know, there was still a lot of racism and prejudice, and even our own family. My grandfather didn't approve of the marriage, didn't go to your wedding, but you went ahead and got married anyway. But Mum has told me these stories about when you went to rent somewhere to live, she'd go and they'd say, oh yes, it's free. And when they saw you, they would say like, oh no, sorry, it's taken.
Well, that's the way it was, the culture. In a small village, it was difficult. It was hard.
So I should say you were living in Bromber on the Wirral, where Mum's from.
Yes, it was hard, but we worked hard. We bought our house and everything, and everything started to fall into place.
Just going back to Fiji, just about the year before you left Fiji, your dad also left, didn't he?
Well, in those days, all the immigrants that came from India to Fiji, the Fijian government had a scheme for one child per family to return to be repatriated to India on a free passage. So my father went. He was curious because when his parents left the village in India, they left cousins and whatever, their brothers and sisters, my dad's uncles and aunties. So my dad, he thought he'll go and find his roots. So when he went to the village in India, he did find some cousins and family that looked like us.
They were the family, no?
Yes.
Yeah. And where was he? Do you remember?
He was in Faizabad, which is Uttar Pradesh.
And so when you're in Liverpool and on the Wirral, he's writing to you saying that he's going to come.
I had received a letter from him, last letter in 1962. He said he was travelling, he was going back to Fiji eventually, and then his letter stopped. But I was too busy working, too involved in my own whatever I was doing. So we did not even think about looking for him or searching for him. And suddenly, 5 years later, we discovered that he just disappeared from the face of the earth. There's no sign of him.
So your dad disappeared and was never heard from again?
No, never heard from him.
Now this is something that we'd like to pursue, and I know back in the 60s when you were young, and we didn't have the same connectivity then or the same connections. You didn't have any money, really. And your mum, you know, is obviously just a lady, lovely lady living on a farm and in Fiji. We didn't have the facilities or the wherewithal to try and trace what happened to him. But I know that it's something that we've spoken about before, is trying to find out what actually happened to him. What do you think happened to him? I suppose it's just pure speculation though, isn't it?
I have my own theory. The last time, I believe, he was working as a driver on a motorway through a huge forest somewhere between Faizabad. I don't know the district very well. I have my own theory, but I don't really...
You feel a bit silly saying it, because yeah. You think he was... You heard in the newspapers about people on this motorway being attacked by lions. Was it lions or tigers?
I saw a program once about the Chinese building railway through Africa, and many were taken by lions and tigers or whatever. And I had this theory, perhaps when my father was driving through the forest, you call it a jungle really, infested with tigers and lions or whatever. Maybe, I don't know.
I think that could have been anything. India, you know, is a quite difficult place to this day. You know, people get killed and
yeah.
Epidemics and illnesses and disputes,
right.
And let alone if you're working on something.
Yeah.
It'd be lovely to try and find out one day, but I don't know how possible that is. But we'll certainly, I think, we'll have a go.
I should have searched for him years ago, but now, next year, I'll be 80. It's a bit too late now.
So we're going to fast forward a little bit, because I think we've done all the big... I mean, you've travelled extensively since, in the last 10 or 15 years, particularly been to Peru, India a few times, Cuba, Israel, Turkey,
yeah.
Mallorca... And you've managed to have a lovely life of travel, really. But we won't dwell on that too much, because it's just sort of holidays, and although they've been great experiences, they've just been lovely holidays. But one of the most significant moves for us, and certainly the whole family, was when we moved to Spain in 1981. Now, the Costa del Sol, Malaga, was a different place then. It was a much less populated place and not so many people were moving. It was a harder place to live, I'd say, in 1981. There were two planes there. We didn't fly there to live. We got the coach. So you made the decision to move, you and your wife, you know, from her village where she'd known everyone for the whole life, and your almost 7-year-old daughter and your almost 10-year-old son to Spain in 1981. What was the thinking behind that?
In 1968, your mum and I went to Mallorca for a holiday. And I thought to myself, this is it, you know, I could live in Spain. So when we went back to England, from that day, I planned to come and live in Spain. So it took us from 1968 to 1981 before we came to live in Spain. First of all, I came alone to have a look at schools for you and a place to live. And next minute, we all came. We had to come by bus because we had a lot of luggage, 5 suitcases and whatever. When we arrived, it was hard. It was hard to make a living in Spain in those days. Work permit was very hard to obtain, and residentship, which was very, very difficult. Plus, there was no, in Spain, as you know, there's no benefits or social security payments. Everybody have to work. Not like in England, all the documents printed in Urdu or whatever. In Spain, the language is Spanish. You have to learn fast to find a job. And this is the way we had to learn the language.
Mum tells this story of me turning up to my English international school on the first day. I was only just 7 years old. And she said, "So, Lisa, who are you sitting next to?" And I said, "I'm sitting next to Neil, whose daddy is inside for kidnap and robbery with violence." And she's like, "Oh my God, what have we done?"
In those days, Spain in that part, Costa del Sol, was known as Costa del Crime, because a lot of criminals from the UK have absconded to Spain. They're all living there. They couldn't be extradited because there was no extradition law between Spain and England. So this is why your school was full with children from. Remember, they're all driving up in big cars and Rolls Royces and all that. They're living a life variety. But it was a magical place. Because when you go to a new country, everything was exciting. I was working. I was selling timeshare. I was arrested twice for not having work permit, taken to the police station. And eventually, it took me 5 years before I got my work permit residential.
You used to have to get the boat over to Morocco every 3 months, didn't you?
There was a loophole that in Spain, all the foreigners living in Spain, after 3 months, you had to get out before you were allowed to stay another 3 months. So all the Brits in this town in where we lived in Fuencarola, we used to get the boat from Algeciras to Tangier. Over there, we stayed there till midnight, crossed the border into North Africa, have our passport stamped. It was a loophole to give us another 3 months in Spain. So we used to come back on the next boat to Spain, and I was all right for 3 years.
You've got a lovely story about going over with our two good friends, family friends, who've both sadly passed away recently, but Doreen and Pete, my best friends, Lisa, her parents. You've got a lovely story about getting the boat over to Morocco with them and trying to find a hotel for the night with the three of you.
Well, it was just after midnight. We had our passport stamped and there was nowhere to sleep. So we knocked on a few doors and knocked on this lady. She said, "Come in." And next minute she saw three of us, two men, one beautiful blonde lady. "No," she said. She wouldn't just bang the door on us. So we had to get away and eventually sleep close to the boat somewhere.
So we had a really lovely, like you said, it was a magical place. It is a magical place, but it was a particularly magical place there. We used to, at that time, we used to drive down to the Atlantic coast to Tarifa with the sand dunes and go camping, because we'd always been campers. All our holidays when we were living in the north of England were all driving down to the south of France. We had incredible holidays. And it was just wonderful driving up into the mountains, in the lakes, and a really magical childhood. So I thank you for taking us there. I'm fast forwarding a huge amount. I'm going to bring us up to date now, because I never, ever, ever thought, and I don't think you thought, and I don't think any of us thought that you would move back to England. You know, England was done for you. When, even though we had lovely friends and family there, when you were living on the Wirral in the north of England, it was a hard time. There were a lot of strikes. There were a lot of difficulties with work. Even though you were successful, you know, it was a bit more challenging than life in Spain. Life in Spain has its own challenges, but it was more of a beautiful and magical place to live for us. So none of us, and also you hate the cold, none of us ever thought you'd find yourself at the age of almost 80 living in London. So tell me how that happened. I know how it happened. Tell me how it happened.
Well, it all happened since our first grandson was born. You were looking to send him to nurseries and babysitters, and I didn't like the idea. I thought, no, your mum and I will come to London and look after them.
So you phoned me up, mum phoned me up one day and said, oh, we're thinking of trying to rent a place in Greenwich, you know, somewhere near you. Mm. And within 2 hours, I thought, right, I'm online, I've found your place and you moved here.
Yeah.
And actually, I think to everyone's surprise is you've fallen in love with London. You really love it, don't you?
Well, we've fallen in love with the grandchildren, two beautiful grandchildren. But I like London as well. It's very cosmopolitan. People are friendly. I walk a lot, as you know. I'm always meeting people in the park and making new friends. I like London, yes. Even the weather doesn't bother me now.
So I'm going to ask you my last question, which I ask every guest on my podcast. And it's about music. And I can't imagine what your answer is going to be to this one, because I know you love music. And my brother, Marcus, is a musician. So you're a big fan of his music as well. He lives in Los Angeles. But if you had to pick one song that reminds you of your travels or your history in Fiji or a really special time or a memorable time somewhere related to travel, what would that song be?
My favorite song of all time has to be Tom Jones, Green Green. Sorry, I get emotional.
Nobody's ever made me cry over Tom Jones before, I have to admit.
Well, there's several songs that I really love. Green Green Grass of Home, yeah, reminds me of Fiji and all my travels and everything. And Roy Orbison's Blue Bayou. That's when we were young, we used to go to the clubs and listen to all this music. So it has to be Green Green Grass of Home and Blue Bayou.
And Mum and I are going to see Tom Jones soon, so we'll think of you because you're not coming with us. You'll be down the road. I want to add a song that I'm going to play. We can't afford to play music on the podcast because you have to pay for it. So I never play the songs at the moment, but I'm going to play a song on this one because I think it's a traditional song, therefore nobody is specifically recording it. It's the Fijian Farewell Song. It's the Fijian Farewell Song. And it just evokes memories of Fiji and just beautiful things, really. So let's listen. Looks like this version is by The Seekers. Anyway, I'll play the whole version. I didn't know The Seekers did it.
Lovely song. Remembering Suba, I said. You have to get the translation for that.
Yes, I will. So it's a lovely song, and it's the Fijians, the indigenous Fijians, not your Indian Fijians. They sing it when anyone leaves.
They harmonise so well.
Well, thank you, Dad. That was lovely. And I think that's a lovely thing to be able to keep and show my children and your grandchildren. And thank you very much for being the person that made me cry more than any other interview he has ever done.
Well, family interviews are very emotional. So this is why I was very emotional as well. Thank
Thanks,
you.
Daddy.
Thank you so much, Dad. I really enjoyed that episode and I hope you did too. I know it's out of the ordinary, but Dad tells a wonderful story and it's a lovely record to have, not only for us as a family, but of Fiji, of the Indian Fijian story, of the story of indentured labour and a time that has now gone by. I know how lucky my brother Marcus and I have been to have a dad like Dad, and I'd like to thank you, Dad and Mum, for all you do for us. Thank you so much for listening to the Big Travel Podcast.
Hi,
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.